What is up, guys? Welcome to the Wise and Well podcast. I'm your host, Herman Lin. This is the show that helps make fitness and nutrition way simpler and more realistic so that you can improve your physical health without sacrificing your mental health. If you're new to the show and you enjoy it, hit subscribe after the episode so that you know when future episodes come out. Also, if you are looking to take your fitness to the next level, I offer one-on-one strength and nutrition coaching that is designed to help you build muscle, burn fat, and improve your overall relationship with fitness and nutrition. Just go to wiseandwellcoaching.com to learn more. Or just shoot me a DM on Instagram at wiseandwellcoaching. I will always respond to you. All right, guys, on to the episode. Dr. Alan Bacon, how are you doing today, sir?
Good, Herman. Thank you for having me on.
We, for everyone listening, we pretty much just recorded a whole separate podcast without actually hitting the record because we chatted for so long before this, but it was all good stuff. I'm excited to have you on today because, you know, a lot of people are interested in fat loss, and there's certainly, you know, from a numerical standpoint and a tactical standpoint, there's a lot of information out there. And I think everybody understands, you know, you need to be in a calorie deficit, and everyone says you got to eat less and move more and all these things, right? But I think the reality is that there's so much more behind what drives being able to do these things successfully. And a lot of that comes down to behavior, right? And I think you do an excellent job of discussing some of the things that impact behaviors that make fat loss easier or harder. And I think ultimately the goal is to make fat loss easier for people that want to do it. So I'd love to kind of just start by you chatting a little bit about, you know, what are some of the things that you find make a fat loss strategy easier or harder for people, and what really drives hunger in the first place?
I think that understanding some of the things that you can expect can make things a lot easier as far as fat loss goes. And, you know, driving hunger is so multifaceted. It's kind of ridiculous. We have environmental factors. We've got social factors. We've got the emotional factors that we you know gain. I mean, it's funny. You know, people talk about cravings and how that affects us. And the largest thing about that is it's a learned response. And I think that many people don't even realize that. But this is a good thing to realize. And we have a lot of research backing for this too. There was a study by Hurl in 2018 that looked at large cohort of twins. And what they did was they evaluated the environmental factors and life experiences that these twins went through. So we have a control where the people are genetically similar. And so what they tried to see was how does emotional stress and upbringing affect these things? And what they found was that nearly all of the effects for emotional eating or emotional eating triggers were based on environmental factors and life experiences. So for people that are trying to lose fat and saying, hey, you know, I'm finding this a little bit tougher than Jane from down the street, it's possible that this is because of learned experiences and the emotional responses that you have to it. Now, I bring this up because knowing this is a very empowering thing. If we know that our eating can be triggered by negative emotions, you know, feelings of inadequacy, feelings of loss of control, a maladaptive stress response, we can start to make changes to deal with that. And if you know that this is a learned response rather than a genetic doom that you have placed on you, you can take control of this type of thing. And I think that a lot of these people that get stuck on the diet roller coaster don't realize that this is a learned response because they feel like, oh, this is just the way that I am. You know, my mom was fat or my dad was fat or, you know, this everybody in my family is, and you feel doomed by the genetics that you have in place. And it's possible that the reason that you have family members that are in this situation is because the environment that you grew up in sort of fostered this subconsciously. You know, if you've got a parent that every time you started to feel bad, they said, hey, let's go get an ice cream. That could be setting you up for future challenges because this is the way that you deal with a response to an emotionally troubling situation, right? And realizing this is a really important thing. On top of that, there's another challenge that people with obesity deal with that other people don't. And one of the things that you were talking about was hunger. You know, why do certain people have experienced more hunger than others? For those of you trying to lose fat, if you were 200 pounds and you got down to 180, compared to another person that was already 180 and had always been 180, you're going to have an increased hunger drive of about 100 calories per day per kilogram of weight lost, different than what the other person has, than a person that has never lost the weight has. This was a study by Hall at the NIH, and they found that those people that had lost significant amounts of weight were simply hungrier than other people. So you have challenges that other people don't necessarily have. And it's okay as long as you realize that, because you can realize that you have the same ability to lose body fat as someone else. You may face a different experience than someone else, but being empowered with the knowledge of why that may be happening can give you the ability to push through that.
So is it fair to say that when somebody loses a bunch of weight, you know, people talk about how, oh, okay, your metabolism slows down as you lose weight, right? And we see some of the effects, but really minimal to compare to how people describe metabolic adaptation, right?
In an average weight loss scenario, and I mean, this is even in large weight loss scenarios, the average drop in RMR, the resting metabolic rate, compared to an expected, what it should be, is between 25 and 50 calories per day. And so when people talk about their metabolism slowing, there's a couple things that are problematic with that. One, even if you've lost 50 pounds, you might be 50 calories under. If another person that hadn't lost the weight is at 1600 calories, you might be at 1550 for your RMR. And so that drop, if a half of a fun size Snickers bar is what's throwing you off on your daily fat loss, you probably have some nutrition work to do. So that's not your barrier. On top of that, people worry that as they age, their resting metabolic rate is significantly going down. And that just doesn't appear to be the case either. Between the age of 20 and about 60, resting metabolic rate stays the same. It doesn't drop. And then at 60 onward, every year you lose about 0.7%. Of metabolic rate. It starts to dip after about 60. But people will often point towards, oh, I turned 30 or I turned 40. Those are usually the two big decades that people say, okay, well, this is where my metabolism got shot. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that there were any effects on metabolism, because there weren't any effects on resting metabolism or basal metabolism. What ends up happening is usually in those time periods, you become more invested with work, you have kids, you have a significant other, and, you know, married life has a tendency to lead to a little bit more sedentary experience.
Sure.
And so
less time for working out in general too.
Yes. Less time to stay active. I mean, if you're single, you're up and you're going out to maybe rec leagues, you're spending time with friends, walking around, you're doing all of these other experiences.
In college, you're walking around to all your classes all the time.
In college, you're constantly moving.
Yeah.
And so people will misattribute this gain in weight that we normally experience in our third and fourth decades of life to a slowing metabolism, when it's really a slowing of our movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so
a slowing of movement. And then you also have, you know, if you've got kids in the picture now, are you eating the last chicken nugget on the plate, right? Are you driving through fast food a little bit more because you're just trying to get something on the table? Like all those little things.
You're right. It's extremely multifactorial, on top of the fact that you're probably sleeping less because maybe your kids are keeping you up. You know, and sleeping less doesn't make you necessarily gain weight in itself, but the longer that we're awake, the more chances that we have of snacking. And so we have all of these things adding in together that as we age, yes, we do tend to put on weight, but it's not your metabolism that's having problems. So again, this is one of those, you're getting information to be able to combat this type of thing. And how do we use this? You know, a good way to start ticking off some of these boxes is to figure out a proxy for how much you're moving. And that's why coaches these days talk about step count so much. Mm-hmm. you know, there's that idea of non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is all the movement that we do outside of dedicated exercise. It's the fidgeting, the walking, the, you know, standing up and down from a chair, everything that we do. And the difference in this can be incredibly dramatic, anywhere from 200-300 calories per day to up to 2,000 calories per day in some agricultural jobs. And so we go from burning 1,000 calories in just NEAT in our college years to maybe 300. And that means that we've got 700 less calories that we can eat during the day. But what do? We don't change the way that we eat. And so we're eating the same way, but we're maybe not more. Moving as maybe more. Yeah. But we're not moving as much. And so the interest in the extra calories compounds and we start to gain weight over time. So what you can do is you can use those step counts as a proxy of NEAT and say, hey, I'm going to wear, you know, a pedometer or an accelerometer anytime that I'm not in a dedicated exercise, and I can keep monitoring this. And particularly as you lose weight, if you're on a weight loss goal, one of your body's main defenses to preventing weight loss is the fact that it will lower that NEAT. And so if you've got a number that you're watching over a long period of time, you can say, hey, you know, I was doing 8,000 steps per day before I started losing weight, and now I'm only doing 6. So you can make that conscious decision to up that to bring you back into that realm of consistently losing weight and not blame it on that half of a fun size Snickers bar.
Which is the more realistic scenario of why your metabolism slows down if you're in a calorie deficit, right? Is it's not necessarily that your RMR, your true metabolism, is slowing down. It's the fact that all of a sudden you are fidgeting less and you're probably not taking the stairs. You're taking the elevator and you're probably driving around for 5 more minutes to find that closest parking spot because you just don't want to walk, you know, subconsciously. You're not even noticing it. So yes, you are burning less, but it's not because your metabolism is screwing you. It's because there's now behaviors that need to be addressed and recognized in yourself, which is normal for most people.
Yeah. And what do we do to compensate for that? You know, instead of thinking about, hey, maybe I should be looking at my step count and my overall movement, what we do is we spend an extra 10 minutes punishing ourselves with, you know, high intensity cardio without realizing that that high intensity cardio that you did for 10 to 20 minutes might burn 150 calories, but you were burning 700 just walking and moving. But that cardio feels so intense that the perceived effort there is much more than just walking spread out over the day. And so, you know, in our minds, we say, hey, I'm working harder than I've ever worked before. You're not, but it feels like you are because you're doing more intense cardio in a shorter period of time, but that's leading to an overall less calorie burn. So we get really frustrated. And we say, oh, well, my metabolism's broken. Mm-hmm. And then what do? Well, we remember that when we were kids, our mother gave us ice cream when we felt bad. So then we start resorting to the ice cream because we were working so hard and it wasn't giving us the payoff that we thought it should be giving us.
Yeah.
And so as coaches, we consistently go back to this idea of empower people through knowledge. And these are those little gems that can help break those plateaus that you thought that you were in. And you just didn't realize what was holding you up.
Yeah, it's such an important point because I've been guilty of this before in my past, but I think we look at workouts as like such a main driver of fat loss and weight loss and all these things. And like, there's all these programs, right, that they give you the exact blueprint and here's the workouts. And unfortunately, what happens a lot of times is You do the program, you do the workouts, you know, like I used to do the T25s and the Insanities. And the reality is like, you're probably not getting all of those workouts in. Life's going to come up. Something's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And when you don't do it, all of a sudden you feel like you screwed it up. It's over, right? And you're not following the plan anymore. And so people then ditch, they say, screw it to the diet. And they start eating more too. And then the unfortunate part is that the workouts themselves were never really that important to the overall fat loss plan as compared to just how much you're moving throughout the day in the nutrition aspect.
Yeah. I mean, weight training itself doesn't really burn calories efficiently. It doesn't. I mean, anaerobic effort is very low on the calorie content. You know, working out for like an hour might burn 200 calories weight training if you're lucky. And, you know, even doing things like circuit training doesn't really raise it that much. I mean, for like a 160-pound individual, you might raise your calorie burn by like 30. So again, it feels a lot worse. And that's the confusing part, is higher rep, more intense higher rep work feels very, very tiring. But intensity is less of a driver of calorie burn as overall volume is. And so that's why if we're trying to use dedicated exercise to increase our fat burn, to increase our energy expenditure, low intensity steady state and medium intensity steady state for longer periods of time tends to work better than higher intensity for shorter periods of time. Now, if you're in a time constrained environment, oh, I only have 20 minutes to work out. Yeah, do the higher intensity because you're going to burn a little bit more. But the issue comes into play that those higher intensities, you fatigue a lot quicker. And so you can't maintain that calorie burn. So you tend to burn out a lot quicker. So there's diminishing returns over time. So if you've got 45 minutes to spend and you can walk or light jog and on a treadmill and you know, watch that Netflix show that you were going to watch anyways in the evening, do that over anything else. I mean, you can even count that towards your need if you want. If it would make you feel better to raise your step count, get on a treadmill and then just walk for 45 minutes to an hour. If you were going to go home and watch Netflix anyways, spend that time working against what metabolic adaptation is going to be trying to hinder you with. And just to be clear, metabolic adaptation is an interesting thing because it works really well in one direction, but not the other. And that's just because of biology. And what I mean by that is historically, as we were evolving, having extra body weight was not a detriment to you surviving. You know, you gain some body fat, you can now last through the winter a little bit better. You can last through those time periods where you weren't able to fell an antelope. There's a very one-sided system in our body that allows you to gain weight because that was never an evolutionary problem. But losing weight was a problem. And when you were losing weight, your body assumes that you're starving. These days, we know that we're not because food is in such abundance. I mean, there are calories everywhere. Mm-hmm. But we've not evolved to understand that. Our bodies biologically have not evolved to understand that. And so our body adjusts for metabolic adaptation to slow loss, but not in most people to slow gain. In very few people, it does, but in the large majority of people, it does not slow you in any way to prevent gain. In some people, you tend to move a lot more. You tend to fidget more. It's those people that kind of look like crack addicts and you know, with how much they twitch and move around.
Yeah.
But most people don't do that. And so our bodies are very adept at sending the signal of, hey, let's not lose body fat, but there's nothing in the reverse to prevent that gain. And that's something that we have to keep our minds on. And so what we've got to do is we've got to keep an eye on those things like neat step count and counterbalance that when that starts to dip.
Yeah. Excellent point. And then I think it really comes down to the hunger management piece, right? Cause you kind of alluded to it a couple of times, but I just think in the, you know, talk a little bit about just how the current environment and status of our food system is and how it is not conducive to maintaining your weight just from a hunger standpoint.
Well, I mean, when you have super palatable foods that are very calorie dense, it's problematic. I don't believe in things like addiction to sugar. I mean, there's never anybody that goes out and, you know, is willing to sell their car for a handful of table sugar. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But when we have cravings, we've got cravings for very specific things. And I think that understanding the difference between emotional hunger and physical hunger can help give some guidelines here. You know, emotional hunger is very sudden. It tends to be instant and overwhelming. And it doesn't necessarily go away after eating. It often leads to mindless eating that isn't located in the stomach. I mean, it's in your mind. You start to think, oh, I want this specific food. I mean, you don't crave food in general when you're emotionally hungry. You crave a donut or, oh man, Oreos would sound really good right now or whatever it is. And it often leads to the guilt and anxiety. And so what I like to tell people when they start to worry about okay, is this something that I need to manage emotionally, or is this physical hunger, is do the Apple test. And I think that you probably heard me talk about this on Chris's show. Mm-hmm. But if you can ask yourself, would an apple solve this craving? And the answer is no. Well, there you go. It's emotional. You're not physically hungry, because when you're physically hungry, you tend to look for something to fill your stomach rather than for specific types of food. So when you know that, you can say, okay, I'm going to step back. This is an emotional type of hunger. Let me give it 20 minutes and see if it passes. And in most cases, that does tend to pass. But managing emotional cravings and hunger that is driven by stress, there's a lot of different things that you can look towards to help give you a leg up. And the first thing that I usually tell people is start a food diary. Food diaries are a great way to identify what might be triggering these situations or these experiences. And what you do is you actually write down the emotions or situations that you are in the hours before you get these emotional cravings. You've identified the emotional craving. So then you reflect and you say, okay, well, what did I do in the time leading up to this? And over time, by following these food diaries, you can start to come to identify some of your triggers. And so identifying some of your triggers can give you the insight into steps that you can take to actually address them. The other thing that I like to tell people is, let's fight food anxieties. And I think that one of your questions that you wanted to get into was, how do you handle situations with food that that you might feel guilty around, or you might feel a little bit powerless around? Mm-hmm. And I think that setting moderated amounts of trouble foods per day is a good idea for most people, because it's a way to give yourself a graded exposure to that food that teaches you that no food inherently has power over you to begin with. And a lot of people will say things like, oh, you know, I can't just have one chip, or I've got this specific food that gives me problems. So, okay, say I've tried this in the past to just eat clean. And that's always right. a big red flag for me when people are like, well, I eat clean.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's great. And, you know, we want to push more whole, minimally processed foods. But at the same time, what you're telling me when you're saying you want to eat clean is that there are foods that are unclean. And so what we want to do is we want to look at foods as either being more nutritious and supportive to our goals versus less nutritious and maybe not appropriate in a given time. And so when we have foods that we consider as forbidden or problematic, it can help to say, okay, well, you know, before I used to have a sleeve of Oreos per day. So how about I have 3 Oreos each day and then see how I do? You know, do I feel better about my relationship with this food? Can I feel in control? Does this make me able to progress where I wasn't able to progress before? And if you can answer that, you know, positive to these things, well, there you go. You've established a better relationship with that food. And you can do this with anything that's giving you problems. And I find very often that this is the best solution that I've found for people that have problems with things like alcohol. You know, and alcohol is one of those things that's just so pervasive and so accepted in society to be drinking every single day.
Yeah.
And we don't realize how much that affects us.
Mm-hmm.
So look at what you do per week. And say, okay, well, can I do better? And you don't have to go from 12 drinks a week to 1. But if you're doing 12 drinks a week, say, okay, well, can I do 8 next week? And then spend a couple weeks at 8. And then can you go down to 6 or whatever it is? And find that happy balance with where you're progressing, with where you have a good relationship with the food, and where it's reaching the social aspect that you want, that balance between the social aspect of your life and the physical and mental health aspect of your life. And if you find that dropping things down in the stepwise manner is really problematic for you, I actually like to then recommend, okay, well, try an essential detox from these problem foods. Now, I wouldn't resort to this first for most people, because this can make you feel restricted. But if you've tried moving it down, and you're finding, I still don't really have control. Okay, well then say, I'm going to make the conscious decision to remove this food from my life for a set period of time, 4, 6, 8 weeks. and then come back and reevaluate how you feel about it at the end of that time. And if you're with a coach, this is a great thing to have a conversation with them about, because they can help elucidate some of your thoughts and feelings on the matter that maybe you weren't able to do on your own. But if you come back, I find that a lot of times people will come back at like 6 or 8 weeks and they'll say, you know what? I don't really need that anymore. And that's wonderful, because then that's your choice. But if you say, you know what? I feel like I'm in better control here and I want to start incorporating this in my life because I don't see myself giving up alcohol forever, then say, okay, well, let's start slowly reintroducing this in the reverse. Let's say, okay, well, you haven't been drinking for 8 weeks. Let's have 2 drinks this upcoming week and then see how you do. And then eventually come to that point where you have that balance of, okay, well, I feel like I have control. I'm also getting what I want from a social standpoint, and things are good. But you can work in both of those directions. I would usually recommend using the first one over the second in that order. But I find that it tends to work extremely well, because graded exposure in some manner can give you that ability to actually take control with some guidelines that you can follow and not feel guilty about the experience.
It's amazing, because so many diets or so much advice is based around what foods you shouldn't eat, right? What foods you right. should avoid entirely. And it's, you know, we talked about before the show, how I used to follow a lot of the advice of, you know, the biohacking world, and like, it was, everything was avoid, right? It was avoid breakfast, avoid carbs, avoid seed oils, whatever it was. And it's amazing, because when I would try to stick to that, and, you know, to your point, like the clean eating realm, I thought about food all the time. It was always on my mind, and everywhere I went, and like every time we were at a party or something, you know, there's a spread on the table, I'm just staring at the pizza or staring at the thing I'm not supposed to eat, and just having this internal battle in my head of willpower of don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And the second that you do it, it's like you failed, right? So screw it.
Well, that restrictive mindset is is very powerful in a negative way. And I'm not a fan of exclusionary diets in general. I mean, I don't like carnivore. I don't like keto. I don't like veganism, you know, outside of moral obligations, or if you have a health issue that necessitates using it. So like for keto, if people have like a neurodegenerative disease or a seizure disorder, yeah, sure. Do what you have to do to survive. But for the large majority of people, I don't think that we can say that there's a better diet out there than a smart omnivore diet. I mean, that's how biologically we're set up to eat. And it tends to work the best from an overall health standpoint. It tends to work best from a performance standpoint. It tends to work best from a physique standpoint. So rather than thinking about what we can cut out, think about what you can add in and work from a positive choice viewpoint rather than negative. I mean, when you're starting to eat more whole, minimally processed foods, think of that as you're choosing to eat in a different way that supports your goals and who you want to become. You know, you don't have to cut out carbs. Maybe you want to add in more fruits and veggies rather than more pasta.
Mm-hmm.
And so by adding things in rather than taking things away, you set yourself up from a much better mindset perspective. You feel less restrictive. You have less of those intrusive thoughts, like you were suggesting. And yeah, what you experienced is so common. And I think that literally everybody that's tried to get in a fat loss situation or a fat loss diet has experienced that, you know, it's time for a different approach. Because if what you've done in the past hasn't worked, then something else is probably a better choice. And you know, thinking about what can you add in? Can you add in more lean protein? The large majority of people are not eating nearly enough protein. Can you add in more fruits and veggies? Yeah. Combine carnivore and veganism. It's amazing. Yeah. You know, you can, there's no reason to fear red meat. There's a reason to fear, there's a reason to moderate fried foods. There's a reason to moderate super fatty cuts of meat for your regular daily intake. There's not a reason to moderate lean red meats. There's not a reason to moderate eggs for most people. There's not a reason to moderate fish, chicken, you know, all these other things. There's not a reason to moderate veggies or fruit, whole fruits. Mm-hmm. There's never been a person in the world that's gotten fat eating apples.
Right.
You know, and we see these days a lot of the fitness professionals saying, oh, fruit's going to make you gain body fat. How in God is fruit going to make you gain body fat? You're going to be so full from eating watermelon before you hit any kind of calorie problem that it's
crazy that we're
It's ridiculous. You know, and certainly you could look at, okay, well, you know, concentrated fruit juices with added sugars. Yeah, okay, maybe we've got a problem there. But whole fruits, whole foods in general, you're not really going to be causing yourself any problems. So, you know, think about what you can add in and then go from that viewpoint, because that's going to be much more beneficial than worrying about, okay, well, what can I take away to get where I want to be? If you add stuff in, particularly higher fiber foods, fruits and veggies, you know, lean proteins, you're going to be upping the satiety levels of your foods. You're not going to have a whole lot of room for those, you know, those other things that you used to eat, but that's okay, because then you can have it in a more moderated amount and feel content with having that. You know, that's where you switch to the 2 to 3 Oreos instead of the entire sleeve.
Yeah. And some of it is also just driven by the sensationalism of fear mongering that we see. You know, when people stand in grocery stores and they scream about the ingredients, like what happens is,
if you've ever seen, I'm going to cut you off for one quick second. If you've ever seen a video where somebody's in a grocery store and they're telling you the ingredient that you shouldn't eat, you should unfollow that person. 100%. There has never been a video in history that has been done in that manner that is accurate.
1000% agreed. And I think what happens is that we assume we have to avoid these foods. And I want people to understand the context of why we even say to moderate foods, because people will say like, oh, you know, Oreos or something. And they believe, because they see these people fear mongering, that there's some kind of chemical or some process in there when you eat it that causes fat gain. And the reality is, it's just that these foods, you're going to crave more when you have a craving and you're hungry. And also, they're not going to make you full. They're going to keep you feeling more hungry, meaning you're probably going to end up eating more calories for less nutrients. And that's like, when you just break it down to just keep it that simple, they become a lot less scary, right?
Cravings are also like, it's like a kid throwing a tantrum from a mental perspective. It's like a kid throwing a tantrum, because if you give into cravings, you essentially teach that craving that, okay, well, if my body throws this tantrum, I'm going to get this as a reward. Mm. And so that's why you take that time. Remember how I said, you know, take 20 minutes. Say, okay, no matter what I'm going to do as far as this craving goes, I'm going to wait 20 minutes. I'm going to put on a timer. I'm going to wait 20 minutes. If in 20 minutes I still want to eat this Oreo, then I'm going to eat this Oreo. That's fine. You're pulling that immediate emotional tantrum out of play. You're stepping back, finish a glass of water in the meantime, you know, and then wait, make it a conscious choice. If it's a conscious choice and you are understanding and knowledgeable about the outcomes from that conscious choice. And what I mean by that is you're working with a coach and you have check-ins every 2 weeks. I'm just giving an example of like what I do with clients. If you've got check-ins every 2 weeks and you tell me, okay, well, I decide that I want to have a larger piece of cheesecake than what I normally want to have. And I'm a very lean individual already. And I'm okay with having that. And then I'll say, okay, that's no problem. Understand that you may not go down in weight this period. And if you tell me, yeah, I'm okay with that, that's a wonderful decision to make. That's a great relationship with food. That's excellent. Don't forget it in 4 weeks. If you look back in 4 weeks and you're like, why did this happen? I said I was okay these 2 weeks and then this didn't happen. Remember that. And be okay with that. Food diary. This is where you make that note in the food diary. I had cake. I know that I'm probably going to maintain weight. Maybe I'll be up a pound. I'm okay with this. Right? I'm okay with this. And then reference that when you weigh yourself in a week and say, I was okay with this. That cuts out all of the guilt. It also reminds you of that. We've got very short attention spans to this type of thing. And we forget that we've said this. And then we look at this 2, 3, 4 weeks down the road. And you're like, well, why have I only lost 2 pounds? Well, because those other 2 weeks, you gained a pound. So you're really down 3 or 4, but you don't realize that because you had that off week and you said that you were okay with it at the time. Be okay with it and make those decisions. You're an adult, which means you get the benefits when you improve, but you're also culpable for when you slide in another direction. And that doesn't mean that the slide's a bad thing. That means you made the conscious choice. So just own it and be okay with that and realize you know, this is a long journey and I'm going to get back on track after I have this, but right now it's important to me. Maybe it's a date night. Maybe it's a holiday. Maybe it's something that, you know, as long as it's not a mundane day that you're just doing it out of boredom, it's a perfectly fine choice. And reminding yourself of these types of things, this food diary is a very, very beneficial thing in these instances because you hold yourself accountable. And then when you have these negative feelings, which you certainly will in the beginning and repeatedly throughout the journey, go back, read these things over. It reminds you, it helps to bump your motivation up by saying, this was a conscious choice of mine. Then you don't feel at a loss of control. And that's a very, very important thing.
I really like the idea of the food diary for multiple reasons. I think one, it helps you stay a little bit more objective with the goal and take some of the emotion out that you feel on a day-to-day basis. And two, you know, I think tracking in general, like certainly there's a lot of benefit to seeing the numbers and making sure that you're reaching the goal. I actually think that the stronger piece of tracking and what makes it so beneficial is the awareness piece. It's yes. Because you are seeing patterns over and over. And it's not necessarily that going every single day and being like, I got within 200 calories of my number is really the part that ultimately is going to drive, you know, long-term sustainable results. It's more so you're going to say, after this stressful meeting, every single time I grab a bag of chips, why am I doing that? Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually like to employ, I think that the mindfulness approach is extremely important, what you're bringing up. Because it brings into focus daily activities that you do or daily choices that you make. And I actually like to have clients follow a mindfulness exercise when they tell me, you know, that they are feeling a little bit lost or they're not really understanding what's happening. I actually have them employ a mindfulness exercise where at the end of every night, this is something that goes in their food diary too. I say, ask yourself three questions. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? And where is it taking me? And so they'll evaluate what they did during that day. And these questions are important because they make us aware of our current daily routines. They allow us to evaluate the motivations behind the choices that we're making, and they put into focus whether or not these actions are moving us towards our goals. And being mindful of these things makes a world of difference in progress over time, because I don't think that we realize that when we're emotionally eating, one of the core things of that I was talking about when we talked about the differences between emotional and physical hunger is the mindlessness that's involved. You know, you've consumed 400 or 500 calories before you realize that you've consumed 400 or 500 calories. Whereas if you were doing that in Whole Foods, 400 or 500 calorie meal is very large in Whole Foods. You know, if you're doing that with brown rice and veggies and, you know, like a cilantro lime chicken,
baked potatoes.
Yeah, that's much larger than what people typically, you know, take in these mindless eating episodes. And if it takes saying, hey, maybe I shouldn't eat in front of the TV, then maybe you shouldn't eat in front of the TV and, you know, focus on experiencing the foods that you're eating, at least in the beginning, until you start to get more of an awareness of what's going on as far as your total intake goes. But those mindfulness exercises can be very, very beneficial because they really put front and center what you do on a daily basis. Whereas I think that when we only, you know, if we check in with a coach every week or 2 weeks or whatever it is, we're really only evaluating ourselves once every 2 weeks in many instances. Whereas if we've got this habit of evaluating ourselves nightly, we really start to understand what we do on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Is that what is happening if you are starting to, because I think a lot of times when you start associating how you feel after you eat something, right, you start making much better decisions. So is that being mindful of what you're eating and actually reflecting on it after, is that how people end up in a place where, you know, you always hear that they've been craving all these, they all they want is takeout, they want burgers, they want pizza. And then after a while of starting to eat more whole foods, more veggies, more lean proteins, it's like you actually start to crave those foods instead. What is happening there mentally or physiologically?
There's a couple things happening there. I mean, certainly your palate changes over time. And anybody that has successfully gone through a fitness journey can relate to the fact that, like, you start to eat more whole minimally processed foods, and then you have like a Pepsi randomly, mm-hmm. and you're like, holy crap, that feels like a lot of sugar. And so maybe you enjoy half of a Pepsi, but you don't enjoy the whole thing like you used to. So there's certainly a change in your palate. And that means that whole minimally processed foods do tend to get tastier over time. And that's a good thing, you know, and I always bring this up to people to let them know this does get easier from that perspective. The other things that go on are you're building feelings of choice and competence. And these are two really important things for establishing a new identity. Establishing a new identity is an extremely important thing on a health and fitness journey, because before you probably never thought about it. But over time, as you are keeping this food diary in play, as you are starting to slowly incorporate these foods and gaining feelings of control over eating, you know, or we're going to keep going back to Oreos, but eating Oreos and not feeling like you have to eat the entire sleeve, you start to feel more and more competent in what you're doing. And I actually find that establishing identity is one of the best things that people can do. And I think that people overall are probably a bit more adept at nutrition than what they initially believe. And the reason that I say that is because I like the idea of when people are feeling timid about making choices surrounding food, particularly if you have like a meal plan or macros, and then you're say all of a sudden traveling for work and have to eat out, or you're going out with friends and you have to eat out, and you're saying, hey, I want to moderate this a little bit better. Well, establish identity. Ask yourself, what would a healthy person do in my situation? 9 times out of 10, you're going to know the right answer. It might give you some apprehension to make that choice. But if you say, what would a healthy person do in my situation? I'm a healthy person. What would I do in this situation? Well, maybe you're going to get a cut of fish, or you're going to get, grilled chicken with like salsa, mango salsa or something mm-hmm. like that on top when you're eating out with friends, as opposed to getting the 75-25 burger that's like, you know, 90 grams of saturated fat one burger. Like you might make those choices to move in that direction that supports who you visualize yourself as becoming. And I think that that identity shift is ultimately what makes this sustainable and much easier. And I think that if you start doing this from the beginning, have that mantra, what would a healthy person do in my situation? And this doesn't just help with nutrition. This helps with, you know, going to the gym. You get off of work, you're tired. What would a healthy person do in my situation? Well, a healthy person would probably put on their sneakers and go to the gym. Even if it's only for 20 minutes, that's okay. This is always an all or something, not an all or nothing. So do what you can do, but consistently ask yourself, what would a healthy person do in my situation? Because the reality of the situation is you're trying to become a healthier person. What would an athlete do? What would a healthy person do? These can guide you in choices, one, when you're feeling low motivation, and two, when you're feeling apprehensive about making choices. I think that this really cuts through the decision-making process and makes it much more likely that you're going to do what you said you wanted to do from the beginning.
Yeah, you have to create a new narrative in your head before you actually change the narrative in real life, right?
Yeah. And you're not going to be successful 100% of the time in doing this, but that's okay. I mean, view it as a third person. If you had a friend that was trying to make a positive life choice, and for 3, 4, 5 weeks, they'd been doing really, really well. And then they decided to have a pizza on the weekend. And this is, you're in the beginning of your journey. You're feeling somehow like this is a failure, but you've lost 5 or 6 pounds and it's just one meal. What would you tell a third person? Would you be like, oh, you failed. Now it's time to, you know, give up. You'd be like, no, that's not really a big deal. Just get right back on track in the next meal and you'll be completely fine. So we empathize with people dealing with these situations when it's not us, but we are so fucking terrible about ourselves. You know, we hold ourselves to a much higher standard mm-hmm. than we hold other people. But why do we do that? It's unrealistic. You know, so view yourself as a third person. Accept that your feelings are normal, that you're going to feel like motivation is down, that you're going to feel like you screwed up, and you did screw up. You probably are going to screw up. Now, not when you're making conscious choices, but you're probably going to have time periods where you eat mindlessly, where you eat emotionally, and you're going to say, I screwed up. That's okay. It's okay to say you faced a challenge or that you screwed up. As long as you look at this as a learning experience and say, I know that I can do better. What would I do given the situation again? And that's the important point. Look at yourself as a third person. Give yourself some grace. Then use those experiences where you've had challenges or felt difficulties and you know, again, write this down in your food diary. Given the situation again, where did I stumble? And what would I have changed if I could change this knowing what I know now? And as long as you're learning from those experiences and consistently pushing that narrative of becoming a healthier person and, you know, making those choices that a healthy person will make, you're going to be just fine. The people that are successful aren't the people that are perfect. They're the people that are resilient. And so start to make these mind shifts, set shifts, start to make these habit shifts in being honest with yourself about when you screw up, but not beating yourself up over it. Accepting responsibility for these things is okay. We're all going to screw up. Every coach that you've ever met has screwed up. The IFBB pro that you're aspiring to be has screwed up. Yeah. But they don't let it weigh them down. And they say, okay, well, I am a healthy person and I'll just get right back on track. And they gain a pound over a week or two, and then they lose that pound, and then they're right back on track, you know, to where they were before. And as long as you keep things in perspective and say, hey, I have the power to make these changes and I can learn from these mistakes, and then, you know, I'm going to get better over time. That's all you need to do. And that's how you keep pushing forward.
And as much as you can, take the emotion out of it, right? Like you just have to be very, very objective with it. And just to everything that you've just said over the last 45 minutes, this stuff's not easy for anyone. You know, we can all have the perfect plan, and then life happens, and you know, whatever, you end up with a bowl of Doritos in front of you, and it sounds like a good idea, but the reality is, the next day you just can't do that much damage in a day or two. No. And so you have to be able to look at it and go, okay, well, that wasn't a great day, right? What can I take away from it? Why was I so hungry? Why did I feel like I need to keep eating? And sometimes it might be the foods that you were eating, but sometimes it might be like, I was so stressed. You know, this thing wouldn't get out of my head. And maybe I use food sometimes to cope with that, right? Those are the moments that are going to change you long-term and sustainably, rather than just finding, you know, the next 21-day program that promises different results using the same methods that everybody else uses.
Yeah. And just as important as, I mean, we've stressed the food diary today, and that's a really key thing, but just as important to understanding your overall journey. I mean, keeping a variety of metrics is really beneficial. You know, a combination of track your scale weight, consistency tracking with nutrition and training. How consistent are you on a weekly basis? Circumference measurements, progress pictures, you know, all of these things are a much clearer picture of how well you're doing compared to just scale weight. Because like you said, you're not going to completely throw yourself off with one meal. What's going to happen? Well, if you haven't been eating, if you've been eating 1500 calories and then all of a sudden you take in 3000 calories, well, your scale is going to be up probably for 48 to 72 hours pretty significantly, because you're going to be holding more muscle glycogen than what you were before. You might have put on a little bit of fat, but the majority of the weight change that you're going to experience is going to be muscle glycogen and retained water. And so by having a variety of these metrics and monitoring them over time, you get a much clearer picture of what's actually happening. And then you don't have to be completely beholden to the changes on the scale. You know, and I had an example of, this is the most ridiculous that I've ever had. I had one client who had a 4-month transformation, and this was a much more significant transformation than most people have. So I don't want to set this precedent, but I want to point this out because people experience this. He started with me and he wanted to lose some body fat, and he had some significant body fat to lose. And over a 4-month period, he only lost a pound for the entire time. He had just started lifting. This was his first time lifting. He only lost a pound. Mm-hmm. But he lost 14 inches off of his midsection measurements, off of his waist and his navel. Wow. And so at the end of this time period, he looked like a completely different person. When we had first started, you know, 4 or 6 weeks in, he's like, what's happening? And I'm like, I don't know. I have no clue why your weight's not changing at all. But we were taking these circumference measurements and these progress picture measurements. And I'm like, look at that. And he's like, yeah, I see it. He's like, but why is the scale not moving? And I was like, it was the most ridiculous case that I've ever seen. And I was like, I can't tell you, but I can tell you I'm not changing your program. We're not adjusting your nutrition at all. And he's like, well, I want to see the scale move. And I was like, you're losing body fat. Keep going. And the fact that I could continually, and he brought this up 2 or 3 times in a row, the fact that we could continually look back on these circumference measurements. And as a coach, you know, we want to give people the most calories that we possibly can while they're still moving towards their goals. I mean, mm-hmm. you want to fuel someone as much as possible. And so we just rarely dropped his calorie intake, and we just kept going as the progress would move. But, you know, the scale can be deceptive, and maybe it was water weight changes. There was likely lean muscle building in the sure. process. Certainly, I doubt that it was that much lean muscle building, but there was certainly some, you know, but that was one of those situations that I like to use as an example, because had I not seen that, I would have been like, yeah, that doesn't sound right, because the majority of people don't change like that. But the take-home message is keep a variety of metrics, because your progress, your program may be working. And if you aren't monitoring, okay, well, am I getting stronger in the gym? Are measurements changing? Are, you know, is scale weight changing? Scale weight makes sense, but it's not the be all end all. You know, what is happening with all of these things combined to give me a clear picture? And I think that the majority of people tend to focus on the scale alone and then make knee-jerk reaction changes to what they're doing. And, you know, either they'll just starve themselves or they'll program hop constantly to where they never actually progress, because they never give anything any time to work. And you know, the theme to this entire podcast is knowledge is power. And so this is another way to give yourself that knowledge that you really need to make the right choices, and to understand on whether or not you do need to make any changes to your program. So, you know, keep a variety of metrics. The week-to-week changes to your weight can be deceiving. And realize that, and then keep pushing forward as the information tells you that you're progressing.
Awesome. One more question. This is a personal question. Why do I, every time, so if I'm working, you know, working on some business stuff after dinner, and I'm not hungry at all, I'm not even a sweets guy. Really, like I'm more of just like a salty, you know, chips, pizza is like my favorite if I have to go for guilty pleasures. But for some reason, there's a point where if I've been working for like too long and I start feeling just a little bit stressed or overwhelmed or something, I'm just craving something sweet. And so like I'll go to the pantry and I'll grab like, you know, just like 2 like dark chocolate nuggets or something. And then I'm usually good. But I've always wondered, like, why is it in those most stressful moments, why am I craving something sweet specifically? And I feel like there's something physiological behind it. Is that true?
I would doubt that it's physiological. I would think that that's more probably emotional or psychological, and maybe a routine that you've gotten into. You know, maybe you started reaching for it at some point. You know, your environment is a big influence in this type of thing. So if you, during the day, are satisfying that savory craving, then maybe this is just your reaction to stress because the other needs are met. And if it's, you know, 2 little things of chocolate, I mean, I don't really feel like that's a maladaptive response. You know, if you feel, oh, I don't really like what I'm doing here, okay, well then wait that 20 minutes and see what happens. Or don't have those chocolates in your house. Or take those chocolates and put them at the back of your freezer, because if they're at the back of your freezer, you can technically have them whenever you want, but you're going to have to wait those 20 minutes for those damn things to thaw, or you're going to break your teeth. So like you've got all of these different ways to be able to handle this. Or have a piece of fruit that's sugary. And if the fruit doesn't work, well, then there you go. You've just told yourself that it's emotional. Or have a Coke Zero you know, because that could solve a sweet craving without giving you any extra calories. I mean, every one of these things is going to be dependent on one. What is your relationship with that food and that habit? Are you finding it a negative influence in your life? And if you're telling me, you know, I'm not really having that many calories from it, it's not really affecting my progress, I don't care. It's fine.
Yeah, no.
If you're telling me it's a problem and I don't like it, okay, well then let's make some moves to adjust that. And the moves are either change your response to that cue in one of two ways. Either do an activity that is personally meaningful to you in one of two ways. Either it has to be fun or it has to be productive. So go do your laundry, go play video games, whatever it is to you that's meaningful and easily accessible are the requirements for this. Change your response. So then every time you start to have that cue, you change the response to that cue. And over time, you actually will facilitate a different habit. That's how you change habits, by changing your response to a cue. You're not going to change the cue, because your cue is when you're doing work at night, or, you know, for other people, it could be like when they're getting off work or whatever it is. The cue typically doesn't change unless you alter your food environment, which is get that food out of your house. You know, maybe your cue was walking into your kitchen and you see the pantry. But if you know that that's not in there anymore, you adjust that. So you adjust your response to whatever the cue is. Or you make a substitution response. And a substitution response is, okay, well, I'm not going to do a different activity like playing video games or reading a book or calling a friend or whatever it is. You substitute a different food item that mentally you're a little bit more okay with. And maybe that's non-fat Greek yogurt with chopped up fruit in it. Or maybe it's having fruit. Or maybe it's having a protein shake. Or whatever, you know, something sweet that might have a little bit of an extra side benefit, like the nutrients and fiber and fruit, the protein and non-fat Greek yogurt, the protein and a protein shake. But over time, when you have that emotional response that you're having, you're going to start reaching for that alternative rather than what you were trying to change to begin with. And habit formation, just to give a little bit of an idea here, when they look at studies with habit formation, have you ever heard that rule? It takes 90 days to form a habit or whatever it is. That's complete bullshit. That's literally something that was made up to sell like 90-day challenges. when they do the research and they look at it, the time that it takes to facilitate a new habit, to change that response, is between 18 and 254 days. And throughout this entire podcast, if any of the listeners have questions about anything that I claim, send a message to Herman or myself and I can get you the studies. I don't mind doing that. But the reason that I point this out is because it could be faster, but chances are it's probably going to be longer than 90 days.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that you're doing anything wrong. And in the research that looks at this, they found that even screwing up this response, say that you reach for the chocolate, you know, 4 weeks in, that's okay. Just get back to the response that you were trying to facilitate. If you do that, it does not hinder that, that new habit formation process. Now, if it's consistent, yes, it does. But if you have random one-offs, it doesn't hinder that formation process. So you don't say, okay, well, I had the chocolate, so therefore I may as well have the entire bag. Don't do that. Just have the chocolate, move on with your life. The next time that you have it, get back to what you were doing before. Leave a sticky note on that bag of chocolate that says, turn around and have Greek yogurt. You know, whatever you need to do to make that happen. But the important thing in all of this is not to say that the chocolate is forbidden. It's to say I'm making that choice because I don't like what this is doing. I'm making a conscious choice to have something else instead. And if you want to give yourself reminders, choose the Greek yogurt. Then do that. It's okay as long as it's your choice and it's not a punishment. Yeah. But yeah, it's going to take some time. It's probably going to take the better part of a year, and that's okay. That doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with you. That means that's how long it takes to form new habits. You've been doing this for conceivably months to, in some cases, when people bring these things up, decades. Yeah. And so if you're changing decades of habits, why would you think that it's going to clear up in 90 days?
Yeah.
It could. But it's probably not going to.
It makes a lot of sense.
So is there a physiologic reason you're specifically reaching for chocolates? Probably not. You know, there's that whole like fitness influencer thing where they're like, if you're reaching for chocolates, you're low on iron or whatever they, there's always these random, it's all complete bullshit.
I'm more thought of it as like, does your brain crave glucose, right? It's just an energy source to basically like give you a little bit of a sugar rush to still concentrate for a little bit more.
So ironically, it's sugar intake tends to slow mental capacity. It does the opposite. It actually depresses you. The sugar rush thing is an entire myth. And this is something that we've all heard throughout our lives. So why even question it? But again, if you actually look at like, you know, neural research on this type of stuff, it does the opposite. It makes you more sluggish. And the sugar rush myth tends to persist because of an expectation effect. We assume that when we get sugar, we become a little bit more hyper. And it's that expectation that typically drives it rather than brain chemistry.
Oh.
So is it you need glucose to focus? Probably not, unless you're doing something like keto and you've just started doing it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're eating carbs throughout the day, your glycogen stores are more than adequate. So no, that's probably not what's going on there.
It's makes a lot of sense. I personally love my chocolate nuggets, so I'm probably gonna keep doing it for now. To your point, maybe one day if it is that thing that's impeding on my goals, but I don't think it is for now. I'm fortunate enough that I can stop after two.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that would be a problem for you. Yeah. You know, if you feel in control and you're doing pretty well for the rest of the day, I don't really see an issue that you would need to change that, unless it's just something that you personally want. And then if it's something that you personally want, yeah, I mean, you control what you put in your mouth. And so take that control and make the choices that you want to make.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate your time, Alan. Can you just let people know where they can find you and all the awesome work that you do?
Sure. You can go to MauiAthletics.com. That has links at the bottom to all of my social media pages. If you would like any information on any of the studies that I referenced today, send me a message on Instagram, DrAlanBacon on Instagram. That's A-L-L-A-N. And I'm more than happy to help you out there.
Give him a follow. Always has a lot of amazing information every day. I really appreciate your time, Alan.
All right. Thank you, Herman. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye, everybody.